Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the Creekside Room, Jan Otto is speaking on Deviled Ham, Mark 5. Let's listen in on Jan Otto.
My name is Jan Otto. I'm the Bible study leader here at Holden for this week. We've been looking at different stories from the Gospel of Mark, and today we're going to look at a story that I playfully entitled Deviled Ham. And of course, it deals with a story found in Mark 5. The first 20 verses about a man who was filled with a demon at a place called Gadara or Gergesa or Gadarenes or any number of places, and about how this demon was sent into a group of swine and they rushed down the sea. So Deviled Ham is a play on that. But I first want to start you in the book of Leviticus today, because as I did first hour, we had a very nice group first hour, which was wonderful discussion and some great insights. We took a look at some concepts that will help us as we approach this story. And I never have opportunity, often when I'm teaching in Holden, to do what I'm going to do with you today, which is actually look at the Old Testament and the foundation of these practices. So if you'll be in the book of Leviticus, the 11th chapter, there are some Bibles on the side over there if you've not grabbed one yet. I want to look at something that has been known as the clean and unclean system of Judaism. Primitive people worldwide have had a certain type of scientific way of looking at the world, even from the very early years. Might you be able to describe the science of the earliest people? Someone here? What would be their scientific method?
Observation and conclusion.
Okay, observation and conclusion. Is there another word for observation and conclusion?
I don't know, but superstition has something to do with it?
Well, yes, that's kind of comes out of the same category of when we don't understand something, we tend to make up meaning about it, and superstition tends to be the meaning that is made up and attributed to something. Especially when it's far out, when we find out later how far out it was.
Experimenting?
Okay. Research.
Okay.
Research would include both basics, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm. Meaning.
Meaning.
Meaning, how are they going to relate to the world in which they live?
All right. I'm going to put it in this phrase. It's a phrase I know you've used many, many times. And that's the phrase, cause and effect. Right? It's based on observation. It's based on a little bit of research. It's certainly based on experience. Cause and effect. Everything that happens must have a cause. Sometimes the cause could be easily determined. Sometimes it was much more mysterious and hidden. All cultures, as primitive as they are, have certain ways of working around the area of cause and effect. The Polynesian culture, when it has something it doesn't quite understand, calls those things taboos, right? What's a taboo?
No-no.
Yeah, a no-no, or something that's best left alone. That's my husband who just walked in. He couldn't be here yesterday, so. But don't you give away any answers today, Gales. In any case, these laws of clean and unclean really come out of this scientific understanding of cause and effect. And the more mysterious a topic was, the more likely it was to be put in a category which was you basically would say, don't touch. Don't touch. Don't come close. To back up a little bit then, is that the fact that these cause and effect kind of understandings preceded Abraham. They're very, very early in the lives of most of these folks, whether they're Jewish or Canaanite, or whether they were Native Americans, or whatever they were, all cultures have had these basic cause and effects and don't touch certain things, the things we don't understand. By the time that Abraham came along, if you were to ask Jewish people who the most important person in the history of their faith is, they would without hesitation say Abraham. The reason, of course, is that Abraham was who?
Father of nations.
Okay, it was called the father of the Jewish nation, but also all nations. Abraham was a person who lived in the east, way away from the promised land. Didn't know what kind of background this gentleman had. But one day God came to Abraham and said, Abraham, I will be your God, and you will be my people. That is the first statement, maybe one of the first statements anyway, of grace in the Bible. He doesn't say to Abraham, Abraham, if you do all of these things, then I'll be your God and you'll be my people. He said, I'll be your God, you be my people. And the whole foundation of Judaism is based upon this thing called covenant. I have a really dear friend who is out kind of doing just teaching now. That's all he does. And his background is he was raised as a Jewish person, is now a Christian. His name is Buzz Kahn. And when Buzz teaches about the foundation of Jewish faith, I don't know of anyone that can paint a picture of the grace of God as much as he can. I think we Lutherans can understand covenant and grace because we try to celebrate that a lot in our own theology. That God could love without condition and without prerequisite. And that's how the Jewish people became God's people. We call them, or they call themselves, the chosen people. Now, alongside Abraham and this covenant relationship, which started as God's act of grace, God's initiative, came the second pillar of Judaism, the second most important person of their tradition. Who would that be?
Moses.
Moses. Abraham and Moses. As Abraham was the one who received the relationship, a relationship of grace called covenant, Moses was the one that received the ability to have some guidelines to protect the relationship. Moses is never held above Abraham, ever. It's always Abraham above Moses. But the Jewish people are so embedded in that concept of the relationship being theirs by grace and gift, and the trust of Abraham and the generations thereafter, that when Moses comes along and gives those ability, those understandings of how to protect the relationship, also known as the Ten Commandments, then you have the two pillars. And the Jewish people have been so concerned about protecting that relationship that in fact they've worked very hard on those ten laws and in defining them and interpreting them and applying them, and a whole set of oral tradition called a fence was built around the Ten Commandments, lest anybody transgress them. Now we tease them a lot, we often ridicule them a lot and say, oh, 613 silly laws. But to those people, they were well-intentioned. They were very zealous. Now, when we start looking at Leviticus 11 today, and these laws of clean and unclean, they fall in the same category as those things that protect the relationship. The Jewish people were meant to be priests to the nations. What was meant to be chosen was not to be chosen and exclusive, and aren't we great, and here we are, and if you want us, you come see us. They were much more to be sent out among the nations to become different than the nations, to draw people to them by the way they lived, by how they worshiped, by the knowledge they had of God. And so what we have in the sense of clean and unclean is just some differentiations between how one lives as a person of God. Based upon, again, cause and effect, things that were very common and ordinary, things that you went through your daily life with, were very common. Those things were clean. They were neutral. But there were categories of your life that had a little bit more mystery, a little more power to them. That was unclean. Now, this concept of clean and unclean, as we begin to look at here, does not have any moral value in the beginning. Let's take a look. Start in Leviticus 11. Let's take a look at what's in these chapters. Leviticus 11 through 20. Sections of the scriptures that Christians usually don't dwell in too much, but ought to. Because it's on this foundation that the New Testament proceeds. The Lord speaks to Moses and to Aaron, and Aaron, of course, is the first priest of Israel. He says to them, speak to the people of Israel, saying, from all the land animals, these are the creatures you may eat. And on we go with the description of animals that are clean to eat and unclean to eat. Now, where in the world do you think they got the notion that some animals were unclean to eat? They got sick. Cause and effect. What else? Anything else? basically. They started eating those furry little rodents that ran across the road.
They probably saw what they were into, rats and things.
Yeah. I'm sure there's just certain things that just were not healthy. And maybe some of those things got thrown in there. Maybe weren't all that bad for you, but maybe a couple of experiences, and let me tell you, that's all it took. So we get to divide our animals by things that are cleft-footed and things that are divided in foot. I mean, divided hooves and those that do not have divided hooves, whatever. I never could keep this straight. I'm not a farmer. So any case, you can take a look at that. And look at verse 7. The pig, for even though it has divided hooves in this cleft-footed, it does not chew the cud. It is unclean for you. Of their flesh you shall not eat, and their carcass you shall not touch. They are unclean for you. Does it make it any clearer? Okay. And of course, we know that a lot of risk around at least early years with uncooked pork and that, and you know. So most scholars feel that the clean and unclean around animals and eating comes from cause and effect, dealing with what you got sick eating, what you didn't, and so forth. Now look, go on, you see fish. And then you go on a little further in 13, you have birds. Excuse me. In 20, you have winged insects. And then notice in 24, by these you shall become unclean. Whoever touches the carcass of any of them shall be unclean until the evening. And whoever carries any part of the carcass of any of them shall wash his clothes and be unclean until the evening. So even hanging around dead things, dead humans or dead animals, became unclean because, as you know, that could be the start of a lot of diseases and other kinds of problems. And so you can go on through this whole chapter and read what's clean and unclean. When you get to chapter 12, you start looking at men and women in their own daily lives and monthly lives, and you see what they're both unclean at certain times, almost always having to do with reproduction. Again, you know how long it must have taken them to figure out how the birth of a baby came about? There's a lot of time between those two events. And it must have taken them, I would say as really primitive peoples, a long time, but they probably watched the animals and they figured it out. But there was something about why doing this act causes this incredible birth. What a fantastic thing. It must be so, we must not mess with that. That's beyond our abilities. So if you look at 12, you'll see certain kinds of things with men and women. 13, we start the leprosy section. It's one of the longest chapters dealing with leprosy and skin diseases that were especially contagious. Now I want you to look at 13:45. Since Jesus deals on many occasions with leprous people, the person who has the leprous disease, in verse 45 of chapter 13, shall wear torn clothes and let the hair of his head be disheveled, and he shall cover his upper lip and cry out, unclean, unclean. He shall remain unclean as long as he has the disease. He is unclean. He shall live alone. His dwelling shall be outside the camp. A person with leprosy was not permitted to live in city limits. They were lived in the outskirts, outside, and they covered their upper lip so that they didn't spit on you when they talked. So you ever seen those pictures of those churches, I think in Scandinavia, that had the little windows for communion? Have you seen those? First time anyone could remember them. I thought they were in Scandinavia somewhere. And there were little windows that were on the outside of the wall of the church so that the leper could come to the outside of the church and hold out their hand. The priest could just reach out and drop the wafer on their hand, and probably did it with a utensil. And that was how they communed. Incredible. Incredible. But, contagious. And we can understand, I suppose, where this comes from. So keep on going through 13 into 14. And notice in 14 who it is that determines clean and unclean. It's the priest. And anytime you've got that kind of power, I always suggest there's probably abuse. And this was a good way probably to get rid of an enemy or two. simply say, well, what's that spot? I think you're going to be in a little bit of confinement for a while, and then, that spot hasn't gone away. And pretty soon that person may find themselves outside the community. So then in 14 we go through the sacrificial system, especially for leprosy, and even mildew was considered a part of leprosy if you had mildew in your home. That's why my house was in trouble a long time ago. I live in the woods, and it's really rough to keep that leprosy off the walls, 15 again with men and women and so forth, and we looked at that yesterday with the story we did look at. 16 and so forth. Now, I want to take a look at chapter 17, verse 10, for example. 1710. It'll be very fun. I enjoy doing this, so. Well, this is useful to you. 1710, look at what this says. If anyone of the house of Israel or of the aliens who reside among them eats any blood, I will set my face against that person who eats blood and will cut that person off from the people. For the life of the flesh is in the blood, and I have given it to you for making atonement for your lives on the altar, for as life, it is the blood that makes atonement. What does this say? What's the scientific understanding revealed in this little section?
Life's in blood.
Life is in blood. Cause and effect. Blood pours out on the ground, the person doesn't move around much anymore. The blood stops moving in the body, the person dies. The other thing that this impacts is the system of revenge. Because you see, if you were killed, your blood would lay on the ground. It was thought to cry out for revenge. And so then, you know, if I killed a member of your family, you would be obligated, by primitive understanding of culture, to take the life of me. And then, guess what? Then my husband back there in the room would come after whoever you sent. And on it would go, and you know those feuds that they used to have. And so what did God give as a way to end that feuding?
Sacrificial system.
Close. He gave us a command, or let's say a quote that's often used when we talk about capital punishment in this country.
Who's Christian? Eye for blood, amen.
Yeah, close. You're on the right track. Eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. What he is saying is that one system of justice, one round of justice is enough. It's an eye for an eye, and it's a tooth for a tooth, no more. So it limits that ongoing feuding of these clans. So it's basically limiting, not encouraging. Okay, well, these are a lot of the things. What I want to do, however, is show you that it's not just clean and unclean in the sense of things that are bad, but sometimes those things could be holy. And that's what I mean about not having moral value. You see, by the time of Jesus, things that are unclean, persons that are unclean, are also equated with people who are sinful. But in the earliest times, when this, it was just big things that were mysterious. And in a sense, so much so that let's not touch them, let's not come in contact with them. Let's be sure that we treat these things well. But by Jesus' day, this has ethical orientation. To show you that, I want to show you how holiness is considered. And to do that, go back to Leviticus chapter 6. And we'll start there. I'll take you through about four passages to show the sequence of this a bit. Leviticus 6. Didn't know you'd be doing so much Leviticus today, did you? Well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to turn you loose on this situation in Mark once I give you some background and see what you do with it. Leviticus 6, starting in verse, let's see here, 25. 6:25 Leviticus. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to Aaron, the first priest of Israel, and his sons, the other priests of Israel, saying, this is the ritual of the sin offering. The sin offering shall be slaughtered before the Lord at the spot where the burnt offering is slaughtered. It is most holy. The priest who offers it as a sin offering shall eat of it. It shall be eaten in a holy place in the court of the tent of meeting. That's the earliest name for the worship center. Whatever touches its flesh, the flesh of the sacrifice, shall become holy. And when any of its blood is splattered on a garment, you shall wash the bespattered part in a holy place. An earthen vessel in which it was boiled shall be broken, but as if it is boiled in a bronze vessel, that shall be scoured and rinsed in water. Every male among the priests shall eat of it. That almost suggests there might be women among the priests, doesn't it? Every male among the priests shall eat of it. It is most holy. But no sin offering shall be eaten from which any blood is brought in. Okay, so forth. It shall be burned with fire. Again, here's the treatment of blood. What I'm after here is look at the touching of the sacrifice and how that imparts holiness to the person who's touched it. You see that in there? Okay. Now let's go a little backwards and see a situation in which holiness is contagious, just like uncleanness is. And that's in Exodus 19. 19, verse 10. I'm so glad I get to do this. I never get to do this much with it, so I just have to just refer to it and say, well, look it up. But today, we'll just take a little more time. Exodus 19, 10. Second book of the Old Testament. Exodus 19, stay with 10. This is just before the giving of the Ten Commandments, and so they're preparing to go up to the mountain, or Moses to go. So here it goes. The Lord said to Moses, "Go to the people and consecrate them today and tomorrow. Have them wash their clothes and prepare for the third day, because on the third day the Lord will come down upon Mount Sinai in the sight of all the people. You shall set limits for all the people all around, saying, 'Be careful not to go up the mountain or to touch the edge of it. Any who touch the mountain shall be put to death. No hand shall touch them, but they shall be stoned or shot with arrows, whether animal or human being, they shall not live.'" I'll stop there. Not just don't touch the mountain, but if you touch the mountain, you've become part of the holiness of that place. And then if someone touches you by implication, right, it's contagious. That's why you need to stone them or shoot them with an arrow. Don't touch them. It's almost with the same intensity as the Leviticus portions dealing with holiness as a contagion. And that's what I mean. Uncleanness did not necessarily have to do with ethical violations. Although by Jesus' day it does tend to take that on. Now I'm moving back to Leviticus, and let's see what happens again with this particular concept of holiness. 16 of Leviticus. So that's a couple books further down the row there. Chapter 16, 23. Back to Aaron going into the worship center. 16, 23, Leviticus. "Then Aaron shall enter the tent of meeting and shall take off the linen vestments that he put on when he went into the holy place and shall leave them there." First of all, Aaron has to put on priestly linen garments before he goes into the holy place, and then let's look at what he must do as he goes further into the process, because he goes deeper, if you will. "He shall bathe his body in water in a holy place and put on his vestments. Then he shall come out and offer his burnt offering and the burnt offering of the people, making atonement for himself and for the people." And then it goes on about the offering. And then take a look at 28. "The one who burns them shall wash his clothes and bathe his body in water, and afterward he may come into the camp." What's your Revised Standard say? Is it using the phrase "into the camp"?
Yeah.
Yes? Okay. But I'm glad that they did that far back. Here again, here's holiness that is not allowed into the camp until after the purification has taken place. So we have holiness as something, if you will, taboo. Stay away. Keep your distance. Now I'm going to take you a little further in the Old Testament, and let's see what happens in maybe, let's say, changing this notion. And that's the book of Haggai. That's the third to the last book of the Old Testament. So if you go to Matthew, back up to Malachi and Zechariah, and you'll find Haggai, and then Zephaniah and some of those little books are all found there. So find Malachi, then back up two books to Haggai. If you find Nahum, Habakkuk, go a little further. This is a book I'm sure we open and read every day, huh? Yes. That's what I mean. This stuff's really hidden in there. The more you know your Old Testament, the better you'll know your New Testament will become make a little more sense. Haggai, what's going on here? Haggai's written in a time when the people had been sent into exile. And the first temple was destroyed. And now we're starting to get to the time when they're going to return home and rebuild the temple. And Haggai is pushing for a restored priesthood, but a priesthood that is based in some integrity again. Let's put it that way. In the second chapter of Haggai, we find the most unusual little passage that's really interesting. And that's starting in verse 10 of chapter 2. Haggai 2:10. "On the 24th day of the ninth month in the second year of Darius, the word of the Lord came by the prophet Haggai, saying, 'Thus says the Lord of hosts, ask the priests for a ruling. If one carries consecrated meat in the fold of one's garment, and with the fold touches bread or stew or wine or oil or any other kind of food, does it become holy?' The priest said, 'No.' Then Haggai said, if one who is unclean by contact with a dead body touches any of these, does it become unclean? The priest answered, yes. And then it goes on about, Haggai says, well, so it is with this people and this nation. And then he goes on to talk a little bit, and then goes on to some promises. I guess the concept that I'm after here is that all of a sudden we have the Lord coming and asking the priest for a ruling. Basically saying, is the holy contagious? And they're saying, no. But is the unclean contagious? Saying, yeah. And that's largely what continued to work into the time of Jesus, was the sense that that which was unclean is contagious, and don't make it spread. Keep those people isolated. Keep yourself isolated. Perform the ritual purifications. But when it comes to holiness, that concept starts getting really backed away from. Questions on any of this?
Just a couple comments.
Sure, please.
I would say that Israel has revelation in what is unclean and unclean more than what the pagans do.
I agree. Thank you.
Okay, and then secondly, at this time, they don't have the temple anymore, so they can't do it.
That's right. And so?
So therefore, the holiness idea drops out because they don't have the ritual system anymore.
Right. But the system of uncleanness gets picked up not by the priests, but by the Pharisees. And so instead of running to the temple and doing your sacrifices and your bathing and all the things you needed to do, you now have the Pharisees picking it up, and instead of the temple system, they have their own system, which consists of washing one's hands. They take away, in some senses, that full sense of bathing and have taken on a more customized ritual. If you were here Sunday, the text that was read at worship service has nothing to do with hygiene. It's not whether you wash your hands good enough to do the dishes and hold them. It has more to do with the fact that whether or not you are aware that as you go into the marketplace, you go places that you're always in contact with unclean things and that you're washing. You wash your food, you wash the vessels you eat in, and you wash yourself. Interesting, yeah.
We take kind of that attitude toward AIDS. We're much more cautious anymore of what we handle, what we don't handle, and where we...
Okay, you can probably take that sense of concern and that feeling you have as we think about that horrendous, awful disease, and you think about that and then apply it to daily life for a Jewish person. Gentiles were unclean. To come in contact with a foreigner? Uh-uh. In fact, that's what that passage about shaking the dirt off your feet. If you go into a foreign land, before you come into the Holy Land, you are to knock the dust off your feet. Not so much because you want to give them a message, but because you honor the holiness of the land in which you enter, and you don't want to bring any of that pagan soil with you. So all of these traditions, all these customs, very interesting. I don't know the right or wrong for us today, but what I do want to say is that to understand what's going on in the New Testament, we best have a little background in it. Yeah.
Another comment. This would help the people in the fact to realize the fact that the Pharisees had this ritual, to realize they are separate from the Gentiles. But secondly, it also, as you have brought out before, it gave the Pharisees a great deal of power to control the people.
Yeah, it did. And because they were basically the teachers of the people. These are lay people. Pharisees are lay people. They're merchants and other kinds of people that did business. They're not professional religious leaders. That's the priests. But the Pharisees were, we would say, be a room of Jewish folks. And there were maybe four Pharisees among us who basically are those committed to observing Judaism in the highest sense of the word. And by doing everything possible to obey every aspect. The more common people didn't have the luxury of running to the temple every 5 minutes when they got unclean. All of us, if we were Jewish people, would live in a state of uncleanness a lot of the time. But the idea was, can you discern the moments of unclean from clean so that when you begin your religious prayers and things like that, make sure that you take care of that which is unclean in you before you enter the presence of what's holy. We're not so different in our own thinking, you know. What do? We go to church. Do we wear our old clothes? Uh-huh. take a shower, take one the night before, set our hair, whatever we need, and we go to church ready to be in the presence of God. We kind of have that division in our lives.
You know, you gave me a good insight on the reason the Phariseeism arose, because he had no temple. Yes. It's just like today, if the clergy goes bad and the church goes bad, the lay people have to take over.
You bet.
And that's what the Pharisees were doing.
They sure did. And they did, I think, a pretty reasonable job of it. You know, we have Christians today that we would probably consider a little too narrow, a little too legalistic, a little too whatever, and certainly. See, Judaism today, especially too, is so diverse. It's so diverse. I mean, there are Jews all over the world. There are black Jews, there are Mediterranean Jews, there are European Jews, and there are American Jews. They were all born in those countries. They are culturally part of a lot of different people. Jewishness in Africa is very different than Jewishness in this country here. But you also have a Judaism conservative to liberal Judaism. And so you have a whole spectrum of where people are. In Jesus' day, the same. They weren't that homogeneous. And so by the time we get to John's gospel, he keeps saying, the Jews did this and the Jews did that. He almost forgets that Jesus is a Jew. You know, because in some ways he's forgotten how to divide the categories. Mark does that. He says it's the Sadducees, the priests, the Pharisees, the teachers of the scriptures, the scribes, the ones who can write and read and know what's in the scriptures, the Herodians, which are part of the Herod party, the Zealots, who are part of the Roman overthrow group. I mean, you've got the parties there. That's why I like the gospel. I feel closer to the action. By John's time, it's always the Jews. The Jews came to Jesus and said, I don't know what Jews came to Jesus. Which ones? It makes a difference. Okay, back to Mark 5. We need to work. Work hard, work fast. Now, I'm sorry I talked to you for a whole half an hour. That's really rude of me, but I hope that was helpful. Mark 5. I've given you so much background, my goodness, you guys should just explode in conversation about this. Really should. There are two other things I should say, however, to bring you up to some New Testament understanding. In the Gospel of Mark, Jesus... That's not Jesus, I'm sorry. I just realized I said Jesus and stopped, okay. This is my map of Palestine, the best I can do. And this is the Sea of Galilee, this is the Jordan River, this is the Red Sea, and this is the Nile River. Dead Sea, what I call it? Dead Sea, very dead. Okay, the Sea of Galilee is in Mark, where Jesus spends most of his time. And what's interesting in Mark's gospel is Jesus keeps going back and forth across this lake. He goes back one side of the sea and the other side. Then you have some things that happen on the sea. What's good to know is that when Jesus is on this side of the sea, he's in Galilee, which is largely a mixed population, but mostly has a lot of pockets of Judaism. It's a clean place to be, okay? And when he's over here, he is over in definitely Gentile turf, and it is as unclean as you can get. In fact, most people didn't set foot in that side of the sea. Today, where is he going to be? With the Jewish people or the unclean people?
Unclean.
You bet. He's over here. There are three possible locations. If you're interested, you can look them up on a map. Each of them sit differently. There's Gadara, there's Gergesa, and there's Gadara, Gergesa, and Gerasene. Gerasa. Gerasa, Gergesa, Gadara. Probably because the spelling was not clear enough, and there's three locations. They all are on that side of the sea. They all are close. Some are closer than others to the sea. Good question for Ralph Gehrke. Find out what he thinks that where that was. It's a good question for an archaeologist. Someone who's been there and has looked at that. He's one of my former professors, so it's fun to have him here. Any case, Jesus is on this side of the sea, and what's good in Mark's gospel to know is that the message Jesus gives over here is different than it is over here, because he's speaking to two different groups. A little clue about this. There was a city that Herod Antipas, who was the part Jewish governor of Galilee, who was only governor because the Roman government let him be, wanted to do something to honor the emperor Tiberius. So what did he do? He built him a city and named the city Tiberius. What else would he name it? But the problem was, because he had built it and honored it, given it to Rome and put it where it was, He couldn't beg the Jews to come and live with it. They didn't want to have anything to do with it. They wouldn't go there. So once, the first thing that starts out in this gospel is the scandal of Jesus being somewhere where more Jews usually were not. So that's the first thing to know, is the crossing of the sea and where he is. The second clue I will give you has to do with a word in this text. And that word is the word legion. When I first started teaching this about 6 years ago, because somebody tipped it off to me at that time, people sat in the room and they stared at me like I had gone out of my head. Now, as I'm reading more and more books, which someday I have to lift up and show you some of my sources, I'm seeing it more and more in scholarship. In fact, one of our professors at Luther Northwestern now has even adopting this, and it's like, yeah, all right, okay. So I don't feel like I'm out in left field so much. But this word legion, when it occurs in the scriptures where it does, is not a Greek word. It is not an Aramaic word like talitha kum or ephatham. It is not a Hebrew word. So what's left?
Roman.
Yes, it's a Latin word. And it comes from the people's language of Rome. It is a Roman word. And what does legion mean?
Many.
Well, that's where we started with this. When the scholars first began working on this some years back, they read that, and it's because the person says, my name is legion, for we are many. And so they felt the parallelism means, many means legion. So one of the first interpretations of this meant many. And it influenced our understanding of demons, that every time a demon possesses a person, it means there are many of them there. Okay? Well, about 15 years ago, we had some linguists look at this, and they said, why in the world would Mark choose a Latin word? Why didn't he choose a Greek word for many? And they thought about that. Why doesn't Mark just say, my name, we are, was it, hola, allo, one of those kind of Greek words, meaning many or much. Why doesn't he do that? Why does he choose a Latin word, a Roman word, when Jesus is over here? And so they said, well, you know what literally means in Latin? It means a Roman military unit, of which there were many throughout Palestine, and the legion was composed anywhere of 2,000 to 6,000 men. I'm going to tease you that much because I'm going to turn you loose on the text. Let's read it first and then move into small groups. See what you do with this story. What do you do with that? And then we'll come back together and see where we come from. This morning, people had wonderful insights. I was just really amazed. It was great. Okay, here we go. Oh, let's have someone else read it. I've been hearing, you've been hearing my voice now. Someone read, please, 1 through 20.
They came to the other side of the sea, to the country of the Gerasenes. And when he had come out of the boat, there met him out of the tombs a man with an unclean spirit, who lived among the tombs. And no one could bind him anymore, even with a chain. For he had often been bound with fetters and chains, but the chains he wrenched apart, and the fetters he broke in pieces, and no one had the strength to subdue him. Night and day, among the tombs and on the mountains, he was always crying out and bruising himself with stones. And when he saw Jesus from afar, he ran and worshipped him. And crying out with a loud voice, he said, what have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I adjure you, by God, do not torment me. For he, I suppose it's Jesus, had said to him, come out of the man, you unclean spirit. And Jesus asked him, what is your name? He replied, my name is Legion, for we are many. And he begged him eagerly not to send them out of the country. Now a great herd of swine was feeding there on the hillside. And they begged him, send us to the swine, let us enter them. So he gave them leave. And the unclean spirits came out and entered the swine, and the herd, numbering about 2,000, rushed down the steep bank into the sea and were drowned in the sea. The herdsmen fled and told it in the city and in the country, and people came to see what it was that had happened. And they came to Jesus and saw the demoniac sitting there, clothed and in his right mind, the man who had the legion. And they were afraid, and those who had seen it told what had happened to the demoniac and to the swine. And they began to beg Jesus to depart from their neighborhood. And as he was getting to the boat, the man who had been possessed with demons begged him that he might be with him. But he, Jesus, refused and said to him, "Go home to your friends and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he has had mercy on you." And he went away and began to proclaim in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him. And all men...
Name what?
Pigs.
Pigs.
Tombs.
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 Herds.
The Holy Spirit? What?
This bloody wild man.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. Unclean land, too.
Unclean land.
We even thought maybe unclean sea, with the pigs going to the sea, does that make the sea unclean?
Well, you know, someone this morning at 7:45 had a great observation that the story that precedes this is Jesus calming the sea. And so the very sea that Jesus calms gets stirred up again. But, you know, it was actually a very interesting comment about that. I had never put those two together, but very interesting. Well, let's start. Where would you like to start? Somebody just throw out something or what you observed or what you think.
Do you think this man was Jewish or was he Gentile?
Oh, I think he was Gentile. To be among the tombs, he would never have been a Jewish person.
But he was unclean. Where else could he go?
Well, he could go any place, lots of wilderness areas and so forth. But, you know, first to be on that side and then end up being in the tombs, that's very unlikely to be Jewish.
It seemed to me Jesus being a great, great risk taker here. So many unclean things. And he's going there. He's going to get criticized when he goes back.
Yeah.
And yet he is the Lord of the whole situation.
He really is. I mean, the amount of uncleanness that this man encounters is just incredible. You know, that's a real message.
I'm going to ask you again, Jen. Up in 5:1 and the 2, it talks about when a man with an evil spirit, and down below Jesus says, this man, come out of this man, evil spirit, and yet from then on it's them, us, they.
Right, right.
Demons.
Yeah. Evil spirit is not the best translation. It's unclean spirit. That word evil continues to bring that moral sense that does exist, but still is better translated unclean. That puts it in the context of Jewish understanding. Unclean spirits is a larger category than demon possession. Every demon-possessed person, it has an unclean spirit. But not every person with an unclean spirit is possessed by a demon. Jewish understanding of an unclean spirit can be a person who's a false teacher, because out of their mouth comes false teachings, out of the unclean spirit. It can have something to do with a blasphemer who misuses God's name. I mean, unclean spirit is a broader category. Demon possession is a smaller one.
So is man one or both, you think?
Well, kind of, it kind of suggests both.
Yeah, I would say he's talking to a demon later on.
All right.
Yeah, Mark especially deals with the demons, casting out his demons. It seemed to me he's got practically every aspect of uncleanliness and demon possession both here. So it's the story.
Yes, this story is so key with clean and unclean. Remember, we're going to go from here to the stories we looked at yesterday with Jairus' daughter and the woman with hemorrhage. But first, we're going to stay on that side of the sea, and then we're going to cross and come back to deal with Jairus' daughter. So uncleanness is found on both sides of the sea, but it seems to suggest that on this side, in this story, this is about as unclean as it gets. You've got so much going on here, it's not funny.
Well, we were sort of wondering also then, something else that you were asking us, what's the intimation of the Latin word legion? And is there some sort of metaphor to the Roman possession, of course, of all the land, but their dominance of the Gentile region?
Yeah. They were as unclean as they could. They were hated. I can't tell you, I don't know that we can capture the sense of hatred toward these people who came into their land, came through it probably in a 24-hour period, like Blitzkrieg of Germany in the Second World War, who came in and destroyed and leveled everything and set up everything under their control. You know, I don't know if communism in the 1950s would be a good metaphor of fear and hatred. Although it never came into our, you know, to our country proper as far as an invasion force. But these people are invaders. And one of the concepts that the Messiah would be one who would come and throw these dogs out and establish the purity again of the people. So there's something going on here with that. Yeah.
Do you think, does the word legion have anything to do with the strength that he had to break shackles? And
I think so, maybe.
Snap the...
Mm-hmm. Okay, so other observations? Yeah.
The word legion meant a lot to me.
Okay.
Because of my husband being overseas, you know, during World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And here, go home to your friends and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he has had mercy on you, letting him come back safe and sound. It means a lot to me.
Okay, personal reflection.
Another supporting thing for the Romans and this legion thing is the use of metal here. You've got chains and shackles that the Jews, I mean, they were primitive people. They didn't use that much metal instruments and that type of thing, maybe bronze or copper, but not iron.
Yeah, it began to come in, especially the sense of iron, because the Iron Kingdom was the Kingdom of Rome in their understanding of the kingdoms and their metals.
We were talking, too, in our story about the idea of this man, if he had a legion of spirits within him, thinking in the military concept, that doesn't just mean a large group, you know, doing whatever they want, their own thing, but an organized group with one specific goal, and that's why they had such control of this thing.
Hmm. Interesting insight, yeah.
In this translation, they don't call the man Legion, it's Lot. And it's a contemporary, it says, my name is Lot, because I have lots of evil spirits.
And that's exactly what it would have been in the Greek if Mark had not chosen to use the Latin word. Mm-hmm. And it's that Latin word that we've stumbled over now in more recent scholarship. What is the significance of him? Out of all the words, he could have chosen an Aramaic word, he could have chosen a Hebrew word, he could have chosen a Greek word, but he chose the Latin word. What's going on?
I think that or I've heard a lot that Mark was written specifically for Gentiles.
And I would say not. The reason is that he has far too much scriptural background that he supposes of the reader.
Okay. Well, anyway, another observation, it's a very clever way of getting in a slam at the Romans.
Yes.
And just putting that one word in there. And they wouldn't realize what's going on, but people who were astute and led by the Spirit, they would catch this thing.
Mm, okay.
I kind of like the parallel you drew just a moment ago. You know, we said sort of a metaphor of these human elements in Palestine, and then you intimated that the Jewish hope was for this great warrior to come down and muster the people and cast these people out. And of course, that's our hope that will happen later. That's what the Jews wanted then. But Jesus came down and he was dealing with legions of spirits in the spiritual realm and gave us a way to be clean spiritually. And I think that's the connection that the Jews missed and that the Christians gained.
Okay. All lots of much of our New Testament theology comes out of these stories and how Paul and Peter and all those other writers are using this as their images in those letters. And who is that? You know, it's like that's their foundation, the Gospels, and then on the Gospels, the foundation is the Old Testament, and so we keep these foundational levels. It's thick. It's a real thick piece. One more comment, and I'm going to share an observation. We got to quit.
Does this take place in one of the Decapolis cities?
I don't think they're one of them. I'm not positive that any of those three options are.
Because they are, like you said, and I've seen one of them, they are strictly Roman cities. They are built like Rome was built.
Yeah.
And I mean, if it took place there or right outside of it, his use of the word legion and hooking that up with the Romans are the unclean, dirty dogs around here, you know.
Amen.
It's powerful.
Okay. I'll give you just an observation. Take it, leave it, do what you need. I think that there are two levels that Mark is writing here. The first level, the basic level, is just a basic story of Jesus casts out a demon. And that demon is unclean. And boy, that demon is so unclean, he's just the chief of uncleanness with all the many, 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 many. Then I think Mark, however, writes a second level, and that level is tongue-in-cheek. What's that mean?
deeper and hidden.
Yeah, he has some irony here. He has maybe even a sense of humor. In fact, I think they laughed right out loud. That's why I call this devil Ham, because I think Mark is a little bit of a ham at this point.